You're listening to Robert Wright's Non-Zero Podcast.
Hi, Ron.
Hey, Bob.
How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
I am not complaining. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright, editor-in-chief of the Non-Zero newsletter, to which everyone should subscribe. This is a Non-Zero podcast, to which everyone should subscribe. And you're Ron Campius, a repeat visitor to this venue, longtime journalist. You were with the Associated Press for a long time, in bureaus like New York, Jerusalem, London. And you've also reported from Afghanistan, Bosnia, West Africa. And you've worked for the Jerusalem Post. Most recently, you were Washington bureau chief at JTA, which originally stood for Jewish Telegraphic Agency, although these days I think they use a different technology to disseminate their content. Yeah. But anyway, now, as of a few months ago, you are retired.
Yeah.
Right?
I am.
You're still dressing as if you weren't retired. Like, what? Are you having trouble with the transition? You've got lapels.
I'm just trying to look decent. Usually I walk around in a t-shirt.
Okay. Well, that's what most of the podcasters do, you know. So really, could you change into more appropriate attire? Yeah, and I'm really looking forward to this because for one thing, now that you're retired, I assume you'll, you know, we'll see a whole new, you know, Ron Campius Unplugged, who just is like spouting like crazy ideas that have long been circulating in your head, but you were constrained from expressing. And if you don't want to do that, you can just leave that to me. I'll do it. Anyway, we're going to talk about Trump's crusade against anti-Semitism. I have a theory that I'm going to eventually try out on you, which is that Trump's crusade against anti-Semitism is actually making the anti-Semitism problem worse. At least in some circles, it seems to me it's kind of bound to, but we'll get to that. First, you know, it has basically two dimensions, I guess. I mean, there are immigrants. Trump has tried to deport a number of immigrants who, according to the administration, are, I guess, anti-Semitic. That's typically not the formal reason for justifying the deportation. They say things like they support Hamas, but you know, it's being depicted as part of an anti-Semitism crusade. And of course, the other big area is campus, where they're cutting off funding for, among other things, an alleged failure to address anti-Semitism. And there's some intersection between these two because some of the immigrants are on campus. In fact, the most prominent cases tend to be associated with campuses of immigrants. They've tried to deport. You know, in the case of the campuses, there are other rationales at work. There's you know, anti-DEI, they're too woke and so on. But the anti-Semitism thing is a prominent part of the rationale. So anyway, first of all, so far, would you correct anything I've said or add to it?
No. Yeah, everything I think you're saying is right. I think that, you know, I think I'm probably going to agree with you that this is not a way to fight anti-Semitism that is making anything safer for Jews. I mean, maybe we'll have disagreement as to why that is, but I certainly agree with you on that.
Yeah.
I think that the, I don't know if they've, I think they have said that, and I mean, they're proxies, like just today, Stefanik, you know, the New York congresswoman who was supposed to be the UN ambassador, then withdrew it because they're so perilously close to losing the House. She said that she used the word anti-Semitism in supporting what the Trump administration is doing with Harvard University, for instance. And even in their official documents, they make, you know, they talk about unsafe for Jews and not protecting Jews. And in terms of the deportation orders they've issued against Mahmoud Khalil and Bruce at Columbia and Rusmaya Ozturk at Tufts, they go into their ideology. They look like, I mean, the only thing that they've cited with Ozturk is an op-ed that she co-authored for the Tufts student newspaper that was very critical of Israel. Used language that I wouldn't use personally, but certainly language that's within the parameters of the debate over the Gaza war that a lot of other people have used, and that it's impossible.
Particularly genocide, right? And she said Israel had violated international law, but that's pretty clear. I mean, America has, Israel has. I assume the most controversial term was genocide.
I'm presuming, but all they're doing is citing the op-ed and not explaining even what they... and she endorsed boycotting Israel Tufts boycotting Israel. Those are things that are certainly subject to debate. We can talk about, but that's not the point here. The point is that they are subject to debate. They shouldn't be used. They shouldn't be weaponized into penalizing people by completely disrupting their lives through deportation and, you know, for a period, incarceration, because that's what's happening to them now. These people are effectively imprisoned. So that's, in any case, just to go back to the point, I do think that they are painting it as fighting anti-Semitism when they do these things.
Mm-hmm. Now, the Trump's kind of war on college campuses, the way he talked about it before he was elected, I think generally didn't include this dimension. It was much more about being too woke, about DEI. But now the anti-Semitism thing is a more prominent, a much more prominent part of the stated rationale. And of course, things have happened since some of what he said, including October 7th. But do you have a theory as to why that? Had you expected this? I mean, and in any event, do you have a theory as to why it seems to have kind of come to the forefront? I mean, the anti-Semitism theme as part of his war on college campuses.
Yeah, I mean, I think I did expect it because it was outlined last year in that very sort of otherwise spare 1.5-page Republican platform where they said they were going to talk about deporting, it's essentially the Trump platform. They were talking about deporting students, activists, and they did, I don't know. I think that certainly in Congress last year now that I think of it, when Mike Johnson, as Speaker, vastly expanded scrutiny of universities, he was going after funding. You know, it wasn't just Virginia Fox's Education Committee, but he expanded it specifically to the Ways and Means, which oversees taxes. So it was clear that funding was certainly in the Republican crosshair. So I don't think that's a surprise. The extent to which he's doing it, you know, that going after Harvard now, cutting off Columbia. Cutting off funding for Columbia and with Harvard threatening their tax exempt status and likening, you know, people, Trump, and I don't know if it's Trump so much his surrogates like Chris Rufo and others, likening Harvard to Bob Jones University, which abjured in the 1980s, abjured public funding so it could maintain its segregation policies. That kind of thing, I don't know if we would have anticipated them going this far. It's escalating. Even, you know, and Chris Rufo uses that verb, escalating. That's, and he's happy about it. But, I mean, that is what's happening.
Yeah. And you're saying the anti-Semitism thing was part of the rationale, at least by the time of the Republican convention?
Yeah. The whole unsafe place for Jews on campus was definitely part of the rationale. Mm-hmm. And I don't want to downplay the fact that there have been, it's interesting. The Washington Post just put up a story maybe an hour before you and I got on saying that they looked through the documents on the Harvard thing and there's nothing there. There's nothing in what the Trump administration has sent in terms of its letters to Harvard, in terms of its statements, its orders to the IRS to investigate Harvard. It actually outlines what exactly endangered students on campus, but it has happened. I mean, Columbia was an intimidating place for Jewish students. Just now, today again, a student was charged with assaulting two Jewish student activists on DePaul campus in the Chicago area. It's all caught on film. The guy's wrapped in a Israeli flag, and he's talking in a modulated way about why he's pro-Israel, and then suddenly two people start beating him up. So that's those are absolutely dangerous that existed, and but they're using that as a pretext to go way beyond. And you know, if you're asking why, I think it's because, I mean, I'm going to plug my own Substack here if you don't mind.
So is this new? Is your Substack new?
Yeah, well, it started after I retired. So yeah, roncampia.substack.com. But on my Substack, I likened it, you know, in terms of like the cinematic, the horror movie existence we're now being forced to undergo. The whole relationship with the Jews, with you know, the Trump administration's relations with the Jews is like strangers on a train. You know, if you know that classic Hitchcock film, it's a very sinister guy telling somebody else whose marital woes are a matter of public knowledge because this other person, played by Farley Mowat, is a tennis pro. And so this the person named Bruno, who's played by Robert Taylor, says, it crisscross, I will kill your wife if you will kill my father. And that's the kind of thing that I think that the Trump administration is putting the Jewish community in, saying, you know, I'll take care of this anti-Semitism issue for you, but I'm going to create a lot of precedents and I'm going to habituate or normalize a bunch of ideas that are going to help me in doing a bunch of other things, which includes going after universities, limiting the freedoms of academia, blurring the whole issue of free speech, deporting immigrants we don't like. You know, Trump, it sounds good, and I think some Jews have taken sucker in the fact saying I'm going to go after anti-Semitism. This is a guy who's also endorsed the white supremacist idea that there's this terrible persecution of whites in South Africa. And, you know, that's tied into this whole idea that there is some kind of anti-white conspiracy around the world. So when does Trump start using the same pretexts he's used to deport supposedly anti-Semitic students to deport anti-white students? And, you know, and this is where I get what you were saying. This is not good for the Jews, because he's going to say, Trump and his people are going to say, but we did this to protect Jews. Why can't we do this to protect whites or some other class of people that we think are under assault? And then people are going to say, wait, so he's right. He did do it for the Jews, and the Jews didn't speak out. And I think, and a lot of Jews are speaking out. It's not going to stop anti-Semites in the future from saying they didn't speak out, but a lot of Jews are speaking out. But that's a dangerous position that he is putting the community in.
So your concern is kind of like the one expressed by Michael Roth, the president of Wesleyan, in the recent New York Times op-ed, that kind of eventually they always come for the Jews. I mean, you might not put it that categorically, but that's the idea.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily Trump that's going to come for the Jews. But, you know, it's certainly there are Trump-adjacent people like Elon Musk and like this guy, Ed Martin, who he wants to be the U.S. attorney for D.C., one of the most influential U.S. attorneys in the country. And there's a woman who's a deputy spokeswoman at the Pentagon who has peddled white nationalist neo-Nazi conspiracy theories about the foundation of the ADL, which had to do with the lynching of Leo Frank. In other words, basically arguing that Leo Frank's lynching in 1915 was justified. That those people being in his circle, it doesn't make me feel very confident that these things won't be actually directly weaponized against Jews. Never mind what I just explained in terms of like others are going to weaponize it against Jews because he's being so promiscuous with how he's using it. He's using these powers, you know, ostensibly on behalf of Jews.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have a slightly different take on the Michael Roth op-ed. And first of all, let me say, I have nothing but warm feelings for Michael Roth because about God knows how long ago, more than 15 years ago, I was taking my daughter around to college campuses. We were walking by Wesleyan, and a guy walks down the steps of the administration building and says, "Can I help you?" And it's like, it's the president of Wesleyan, Michael Roth. Well, this is service. This is what I want, Nicole. You pay tuition. The president personally, you know, tends to your needs. We had a very nice conversation. I also have a lot of respect for him as a college president in general. But I think you could go further with the argument that this can ultimately contribute to anti-Semitism, or take it along another dimension, which is that one thing that contributes to anti-Semitism is the perception, as you know, that Jews are in the background running things, doing various things you don't like, right? And of course, you know, one complicating factor is that, you know, there is an Israel lobby, right? Right. And so influence does get exerted by not Jews collectively, but what you could call an Israel lobby that you could argue goes beyond AIPAC, the literal Israel lobby. And of course, broadly speaking, the lobby includes people who aren't Jews. And of course, there are lots of Jews who aren't part of the lobby. And this is, of course, the source of the anti-Semitism is to fail to add that nuance, for starters, right? And to conflate Israel with Jews, to conflate the Israel lobby with Jews. But the dynamic is real, right? The perception of power being exerted behind the scenes by Jews, even if not accurate, if you look accurately at what the Israel lobby is, I think, a big force behind anti-Semitism. And I would be kind of surprised if the Trump, if driving this Trump policy of cracking down on immigrants and protesters is not, to at least some extent, a desire to stay in the good graces of what you could call some pro-Israel donors. I think Elon, I'll Google this thing Eli Clifton did, and maybe I'm wrong. I think he actually documented such a case. But anyway, you get what I'm saying, right? Like,
oh, I think so. No, I think you're right. I mean, I think that, for instance, there are a whole bunch of candidates for the anti-Semitism monitor, the job that Deborah Lipstadt had under Biden, which is now the ambassadorial level. There were some obvious candidates. And the person he's naming is Yehuda Kaplun, I think his name is. And his claim to fame is that he's close to Miriam Adelson, you know, who gave, mm-hmm. Who I think dumped nearly $100 million into the election, who's was able to get Trump to speak about anti-Semitism just as twice on the same day, both to an organization that she largely funds, the Israeli American Council, but also this just an hour earlier at another hotel in Washington, just at an event on Trump and anti-Semitism. So he's clearly, you know, he feels, I think, that he owes her justifiably. So yes, there is that dynamic. You know, and again, I hasten to say that it's also a fairly commonplace dynamic in American politics. I think there are people who are trying to mitigate it by focusing more on small donors, by limiting major donors, and it plays out in a whole bunch of other ways with oil, et cetera. And the Israel lobby or the pro-Israel lobby can say in its defense it's just playing the game that everybody else plays. But absolutely, that is something that will be perceived and will be weaponized, I think. I agree with you as that goes.
So, the Eli Clifton story in Responsible Statecraft, the headline is the Israeli-American Trump mega donor behind speech crackdowns. It's Miriam Adelson he's talking about, who is the funder of the Maccabee Task Force, which you may know more about than I do. But, you know, I think he's a fairly careful reporter, so people can read it and judge for themselves. This is another part of the complexity is, you know, there are lots of lobbies. There are lots of ethnic lobbies. There's a Cuba lobby, which has exerted real, real influence over our Cuba policy in, I think, a bad way. Now, the Israel lobby is probably on balance more powerful than the Cuba lobby. And of course, there are a lot of non-ethnic lobbies, NRA and so on. And I do think it's accurate to say that the expansion of NATO in the 1990s, which I believe has had unfortunate consequences, drew some strength from Clinton's desire to please Eastern European voters of Eastern European ancestry in the Midwest. So it happens all the time. The Israel lobby construed broadly is, you know, is pretty powerful. And the Middle East is a particularly explosive and problematic area. So you can argue that it deserves, this lobby deserves special attention. Fine. But it is just a lobby. And see, but this gets to another thing that I think there's another attempt to fight anti-Semitism that I think may exacerbate it, which is an attempt to enforce a speech code about the Israel lobby, because talking about the Israel lobby sounds like some anti-Semitic tropes, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
These people in the background orchestrating policy. So, you know, Ilhan Omar, you probably don't have a generally high opinion of her, but what the thing she strictly speaking said that she got, you know, really, really kind of pilloried for and accused of anti-Semitism for was that AIPAC exerts political influence. The line was, it's all about the Benjamins. It was about why some Congress people had voted. And she meant that AIPAC was donating to them. There's lots of complaints you can make about how precisely she specified the dynamic, but we don't complain about that with other lobbies much. You can say the NRA is Satan incarnate and nobody will accuse you of being a bigot, you know? And so I do think that, you know, remind the speech, like I'm not a big anti-woke crusader, but I understand some of the energy behind it derives from the very attempt to suppress extreme criticism of it. Like, that's a dynamic. And I do worry that similarly, the attempt to enforce a speech code about the Israel lobby can backfire in a similar way.
No, I think that's correct. I think you're getting people who are like, you know, like Glenn Greenwald or Zayd Jalani. What is this?
Jalani, J-I-L-A-N-I.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, who are like, who've expressed a lot of unhappiness with what they call woke restrictions, who are now pointing out that the same people that they were allied with a few months ago and opposing those woke restrictions are now imposing a new speech code favoring against any kind of criticism of Israel. I think it's more subtle than that. I think it's more difficult than that. I my problem with Ilhan Omar's thing was also that, you know, that she accused, I think it was the speaker at the time, Kevin McCarthy, of just doing this because of the Benjamin, so to speak. And it's not, It doesn't take into account that people might actually believe these things. I think it's better for debate when you start with the assumption that the person you're debating actually believes what they're saying rather than accusing them of being in bad faith. I think that that's, that applies here in the sense that there's a controversy over attaching the International Holocaust Remembrance Alliance definition of anti-Semitism to law because of its 11 examples of what it lists as possibly anti-Semitic. Six have to do with Israel, and at least two of them are pretty broad. I think one of them is like applying a double standard, which is kind of a ridiculous thing to say, because like, what if, you know, what if you're like, you can, and it's just, you know, I'll just say this, it's a weird thing for institutional Jewish organizations to abide by, because you advocate for the things you believe in. So like, why are you going out, if you're going to go after somebody for saying, why are you criticizing Israel for this when Russia does it or when somebody else does it? It's like, really, like, travel in time back to the 1980s, and you're going to find a lot of passionate Soviet Jewry activists who are completely legitimately focused entirely in Soviet Jewry and not really thinking about apartheid. Are you going to accuse them of being racist because they're only going after Soviet Jewry and they're not going after the apartheid? No, people are passionate about what they're passionate about. So I agree, for instance, that is kind of like a bridge too far. But I think it does stem from the blurring of the lines. You know, I think you said we're going to talk about Josh Shapiro and the person who attacked his the alleged arsonist who cited Josh Shapiro's allegedly pro-Israel. I think it is, no, not allegedly, he is pro-Israel, but who cited Josh Shapiro's Israel postures and his postures on the Palestinians as a reason for attacking the house on the night of Passover, when the Jewish governor had just posted on social media that he's celebrating with his family. I think that's a good case where you can say that, there's a lot that can be said for maybe being very careful when you're talking about these issues. But certainly, there's also, you know, you can overcorrect. People are overcorrecting in the other way, and they're and we're seeing it now. We're seeing it again, like in the fact that Rusmea Ozturk wrote a completely standard issue criticism of Israel from the left. I mean, she didn't even say genocide. She said that there's probable cause of genocide or something like that. I mean, that's
This is the tough student from Turkey.
Yeah, I mean, you know, that op-ed. And that she wants to boycott, you know, so let her, she can advocate for boycotting Israel. Well, it's like, we boycott other countries. I don't think it's a good idea to boycott Israel, but like, certainly there's like, when you're at a student activist and you talk about boycotting countries, it's like, there's a long storied tradition of boycotting countries going back to, 1930s America and the Jewish boycott of Germany. So like, the restrictions on the Soviet Union that came with the Helsinki agreements in 1975. It's not beyond the pale to advocate for these things, and that's where I think that the whole issue of speech restrictions come in, and I think it does pose a danger.
Yeah, and she wrote that op-ed after the, I believe, International Court of Justice had said it was, I think the word was plausible or something, that Israel had committed genocide. In any event, as you said, it was well within the bounds of contemporary discourse and discourse in international law circles. You could argue, which I kind of believe, that the definition of genocide has gotten a little too broad in international law circles, but whatever, she was firmly within the within the Overton window. And, you know, the tone of that op-ed was fairly temperate. It wasn't a screed. It was co-authored. It was almost like a committee statement.
Yeah. I mean, you could see there are Jewish media that would run an op-ed like that, you know, including like the Forward. I mean, imagine my former employer, JTA, might have run an op-ed like that, or at least we definitely would have interviewed people like her to get a perspective if we're doing an analysis. And I did. I interviewed people like who had that point of view. So like, it's just so strange to cite that as a pretext to expel somebody from the country.
And the video of her apprehension was so creepy. I mean, these people all, like, as soon as the guy apprehended, he pulls up his mask. Everyone who approaches has masks pulled up. I think few, if any, badges visible. Apparently, when she said, like, where are you from? They said, we're the police, which I think is basically a lie, because the word police is taken to mean municipal police. They were actually from federal agencies. You know, when the FBI arrests somebody, they say, we're the FBI. I find this very disturbing. And she was a Fulbright scholar, for God's sake. Yeah. I mean,
these guys, I think they don't have permission to enter domiciles the way that police might under certain circumstances. So also that would distinguish you. There's actually people who have escaped ICE's capture simply by staying inside until they go away, and then they go into hiding or they flee the country or something like that. Mm-hmm. But, yeah.
So I mean, I don't know if I'm right, and this is part of the problem, that Trump is feeding anti-Semitic tropes, by sustaining a dynamic that can be distorted into an anti-Semitic trope, you might say, right? Yeah. So, okay, he is influenced by pro-Israel donors. He's been totally candid about that. I'm sure you saw the thing when he talked about how transactional things with Miriam Adelson are, you know? She comes into the Oval Office. I say, Miriam, I've done so many things for Israel. She says, yeah, but I also want this. But if I'm right about the problem, I mean, the ideal thing would be for Trump to be a different person who wasn't doing this. But I also, I've kind of long thought that it might help, perversely, maybe you think I'm wrong, for more Jewish people in particular to just talk candidly about the Israel lobby. I mean, there's there's a reluctance. I've noticed even my like most left-wing, you know, Jewish friends who I agree with on foreign policy, and they are, if anything, more radical than me about Gaza and everything, they seem very reluctant, I think for understandable reasons, you know, to talk, to emphasize what power there may be that's exercised by the Israel lobby. And I think it's because it's just, for practical purposes, it is an anti-Semitic trope because that's the way it's used by anti-Semites. I kind of get that, but I don't know. Maybe I'm crazy.
I think that, I mean, I think the sensitivity, if you're coming from within a Jewish community, comes from this place in the sense that these people will be very hypercritical of Israel. They'll be hypercritical of the policies of the AIPAC in backing Israel. They will be generally critical of the role of money in politics. But they will be sensitive to the idea that there's like this overweening influence only within one party, that only one section of the of the political ecosystem has overwhelming influence, when they know that there's a whole bunch of sections and that AIPAC is to the degree they expect exploiting anything. You could say that AIPAC is simply exercising its democratic rights. That they're doing with it, they're just doing it because they're good at it, and that other folks actually have an ambition of being that good at it. I mean, and there's something to that. I mean, the AIPAC has always kind of quietly been a big sponsor of foreign aid generally. The self-interest in that is because they understand that even though there are people like J.D. Vance or others who will say, oh, we're going to carve out, in terms of our isolationism, we're going to carve out an exception for Israel. And I think they quite correctly don't buy that. They don't believe that's possible. That's intellectually sustainable or politically sustainable in the long run. They back foreign aid. And so other countries, other lobbies, other interests actually come to them to like learn or to ally with them because they're so good at it. And they're good at it. And they're good at it because they work within the parameters they're given, and those parameters are legal and democratic, and other like we mentioned, other lobbies also use those parameters. So that's the sensitivity. When you say like there's something weird and sinister about AIPAC doing what a lot of other people do, and instead of saying something weird and sinister about the policies it advances. I mean, and you're right. It sometimes does play out. It's an unfairness in politics that plays out in other spheres. So somebody who's an environmentalist who hates the NRA will accuse the NRA of being a sinister money-wielding organization, but they're not going to accuse the Sierra Club of using the same tactics or the same means and systems of the NRA, which it often does. So, and that, if you're at the NRA, that's going to seem like really unfair, and vice versa. The right wing does that as well. You're seeing it play out now with the whole DEI thing, where they accuse they're accusing the left of having some kind of massive, sinister lobby to influence education, when everybody has done this in America since the school systems were started. Everybody goes and tries to figure out what should go in the textbooks and what shouldn't. So that's unfair. But when you attach that unfairness to a Jewish interest like Israel, and then the tropes start marching in, that's the sensitivity I think that maybe your friends have. Mm-hmm.
Okay, let me give you one quick journalistic example, I think, of a reluctance to talk about this. I'm curious as to whether you think this is an appropriate or not appropriate kind of failure to kind of mention this kind of influence. So an interesting piece in the Times about a month ago, headline is, as Trump attacks elite colleges, their usual allies are nowhere in sight. The subhead was, the president wants to punish schools like Columbia University for allowing campus protest. College mega donors don't seem to mind. Okay, and then they do mention Bill Ackman, and billionaire who helped get the president of Harvard fired shortly after she, well, it was that Elise Stefanik run kind of inquisition-like thing where they I think these presidents of colleges had been told by their lawyers, like, to be very careful. And it came off looking super bad because, at least Stefanik said, well, if somebody's, chanting death to the Jews, do they belong on your campus? And the presidents are like, so it didn't look great. And then one of them, well, two of them wound up fired. I think all three of them are now gone, but at least two of them.
The MIT woman is still there, isn't she? She withstood.
Was she one of them? I was thinking it was Penn. Maybe it was Penn and MIT and Harvard. You're right. And not Penn, Columbia and Harvard. So anyway, they mention Ackman, but they don't mention that. In fact, nowhere in this piece is there anything about Israel. And that's my question to you. So they say the quiet was punctured this week when Bill Ackman, hedge fund manager, instrumental in getting Claudine Gay removed as president of Harvard, blah, blah, blah. He did not express concern about potential cuts to universities. Rather, he wanted to say that, quote, that only, quote, financial and legal pressure will get them back to a point at which sanity might prevail. And he could be referring, in theory, either to the anti-Israel demos or to the woke stuff. They don't specify. And then the next paragraph says blah, blah, blah. And then it says, but in the current environment, the grievances of those donors against, and this is the way they characterize the grievance of donors, against diversity initiatives and unruly agitators stand in precise alignment with the agenda of Washington. So again, they do not mention that Bill Ackman is a pretty ardently pro-Israel donor. They don't mention that anyone is. The word Israel doesn't appear. It says against diversity initiatives and unruly agitators. Now, I think that's just inaccurate. Bill Ackman is not opposed to unruly agitators. I'm sure you remember the UCLA thing where these pro-Palestinian demonstrators were demonstrating in peace and a bunch of outside agitators, pro-Israel agitators, literally assaulted them. And I thought this was super creepy because the authorities just let it go on. They thought, well, yeah, this is one way to get rid of protesters we don't want on our campus. It was creepy. And Bill Ackman, I think it's safe to say, did not complain. I actually think his wife had, this was before the assaults, but I think she had subsidized one of the groups. So I'm sorry, this is just inaccurate reporting. These people are not categorically opposed to unruly agitators.
And we, at JTA, we would have covered that. I think that's it. You're doing your newspapering a disservice when you ignore that, because it would be interesting to find. I mean, the whole dilemma, I've had conversations with people like Abe Foxman, who's like me, also retired, but he's been retired 10 years.
He was used to be head of the Anti-Defamation League.
Yeah. And, and it's not just him, but I've heard it from others. Like, we're appalled at what, the measures that Trump is taking. And Deborah Lipstadt also said this in an article in the Forward this week, but something had to be done. Maybe this is too much, but something had to be done. And so that's actually an interesting story. Go to these people and talk to them. Get them to interrogate their own beliefs. You said something has to be done, but does this have to be done? Or are you sure that nothing was being done by the universities? Because I'm definitely not so sure about it. I mean, I do understand that there was a degree of stasis and paralysis among the university heads, but I don't think that they were necessarily doing nothing either. They were trying to figure out a way to do it within they're trying to figure out how to tackle this very difficult debate within the constraints of campus speech. And they were at times they were failing. I mean, what's interesting to me is I asked this question when Mike Johnson, I'd like to point out, he convened this press conference of the chairman of various committees in Congress. He did it on the last day of Passover, which is a holiday. Did anybody tell him this? This was in 2024, not this just past Passover. And he had this conference, and the only media that was there, I actually worked a holiday because I was curious enough to be there. The only media that was there were friendly, Fox and Fox adjacent type outlets. And all they were doing was praising him for expanding the investigation of universities to 7 committees instead of 1. They were going to look into the funding for universities. And I had the last question, or the second to last question. And I said, I'm sure a lot of Jewish people will be grateful for this, but what about, making this a whole of anti-Semitism project? As it happened that week, there was a neo-Nazi march in West Virginia, which probably scared the bejesus out of the Jews in the city where they were marching. And there were Jews in the city they were marching, and they were allowed to march. It's free speech, but it's also hugely intimidating. What are you going to do about that? And he said, well, you know, we're sure that the local authorities are doing their job, but the universities aren't doing their job. And how do you make that distinction? Are you sure the local authorities are doing their job? And so the, you know, the, and yeah, and so the attitude of the, and this speaks a lot about what the motivations are, but the attitude of the Trump administration is to go after these organizations that were trying to fix it themselves, and maybe in some cases succeeding and not succeeding in a way that they're not going after threats to minorities on the right. And, you know, they're, to a degree, they enabled them. The whole thing with the Haitian migrants in Springfield, that whole business that terrified them and got them, you know, put them behind their doors. They didn't even want to come out. I'm not sure what the status is right now. And that was generated entirely by the Trump and Vance campaign. So,
You talk about racist tropes. I mean, you know, right. Savages eating our dogs.
Yeah, no, one of the interesting little things, again, I wrote about this on my Substack, that came out of that whole issue was there is a Jewish congressman from Ohio, a Republican, Max Miller, who's very much Trumpist. He came out of Trump's, you know, he was Trump's body man. He was the guy who would set up campaign events, and that's how he got and speaking events, and that's how he got into Trump's good graces, and he worked in the White House and blah, blah, blah. And he doesn't like me because I wrote a profile of him that wasn't flattering, but that's beside the point. But anyways, a political journalist, Alex Eisenstadt, I think, just put together what looks like a really interesting book about the 2024 campaign. And he had some inside info there that Max Miller quietly was reaching out to the campaign, particularly Vance, saying, you know, maybe stop this Springfield stuff because it reminds me of stuff that's happened to the Jews in the past. And that's to his credit that he was able to have that awareness and to bring it up. And so then that's immediately weaponized against him. As soon as it's revealed, that is, Alex Eisenstadt's book is weaponized against him by his enemy. And who knows what fuels these enmities within the Republican Party, but Charlie Kirk, the head of Turning Point, you know, the guy who's supposedly galvanizing youth and was also very close to Trump, takes it and accuses him, first of all, of being anti-Christian, and of having dual loyalties in a single tweet. Mm-hmm. Like two big anti-Semitic tropes right there in that tweet. And instead of calling it out, Max Miller replies by saying, hey, I was for Trump before you were for Trump. Remember 2016 when you were still with Ted Cruz? It's like, that is the state of play in terms of addressing anti-Semitism on their own side. They don't want to talk about it. I mean, good for Max Miller, he wanted to talk about it privately, but they don't even want to talk about it publicly. They don't want to bring it up. And it's the same thing with this Project Esther, this supposedly anti-Semitic project funded by the Heritage Foundation. They don't want to talk at all about right-wing anti-Semitism. They say, if you ask them about it, they'll say, well, these neo-Nazis, they're not right-wingers. They're a whole different breed, which is, first of all, you know, no, there is crossover, unfortunately, as we're seeing in some of the picks that Trump is trying to push through. And second of all, but does, you know, that's your excuse for ignoring them, that you don't think that they're right-wingers, but they're still... They still pose a lethal threat to Americans, as we've seen in recent years. Like that's so. It's just like they want to wipe the slate clean, and I think that's really dangerous.
Yeah, the you know, it's funny when you said if you had covered the story that the New York Times story I just referred to about how donors are college donors are fine with what Trump's doing to college. At least some of them are colleges. That if you had covered it for JTA, you would have done it differently. I thought about that this morning when I came across this. I thought, you know, if Ron had written that for this publication that is for a Jewish audience, he would have been completely candid. I mean, that would interest them. He would be saying, you know, this is a pro-Israel donor. That one's, and they've said this, they've said that. And the Times, you know, I think to an inexcusable extent, well, to glosses over it. And this is another example. Maybe this will put a finer point on where I say more candidness about the lobby could help in the fight against anti-Semitism is, you know, that somewhere out there, the New York Times has a lot of prominence. There's someone who read the passage I just read. And they said to themselves, and they're already probably, you know, leaning, you know, they're probably just anti-Semites, but they said, oh, yeah, well, New York Times is a Jewish-owned newspaper, of course. They're yeah. trying to cover it up. And they, I guarantee you somewhere there's a chat group where that was discussed, you know? And
absolutely, yeah. No, I agree. I think that the more light that's shed on these things, the more normative it seems what they're doing. I've never like quite understood APAC's insistence on, like, you know, not returning my calls. I mean, you know, they do return, not returning all my calls, not answering all my questions, just not being more candid and out there, you know, and people will see that it's, they're not that different from anybody else, but absolutely that reluctance, that kind of paranoia about it does inhibit, I think, a healthy dialogue about what's going on, and it mm-hmm. It fuels conspiracy theories.
Yeah. Okay, so we've reached the part of our conversation where we move into what's called overtime, available to paid subscribers of the Non-Zero newsletter, which everyone should become. although if you're not one and you're only following us as far as we've gone, I still appreciate it. Do you yet have a paid subscription option to your newsletter, Ron?
Yeah, we do. I haven't.
Do you?
Yeah. It's automatic when you go on Substack. I hadn't realized until I started getting payments for a newsletter that I hadn't asked for payments, but it's there if you want to.
But didn't you have to choose the subscription, how much you were charging?
No, there's a default, apparently. A default of $8 a month that I had no idea that existed.
Whoa, you're getting $8 a month?
Yeah.
you want to trade newsletters? This is one reason I oppose Trump's inflationary tariffs is... it's kind of hard to raise your subscription rates once you set them. So you're in effect on a fixed income kind of, or a fixed prescriber income. Okay, so anyway, what's again the name of your newsletter?
It's just roncampiussubstack.com. I haven't given it a special name yet, but right, if you look up
Ron Campius. Campius Substack is one word in effect, or there's a dot? Probably Ron a Campius, dot.
roncampius.substack.com, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And Campius is K-A-M... as in Mary P-E-A-S. That's good. And mine is the Non-Zero newsletter. You know, if you want to, you can think about this, but if you want to make the paid segment available to your paid subscribers there's actually a pretty easy way to do that. I don't know. You'd have to set up your podcast thing. We'll talk. Anyway, we're going into overtime. I'm gonna a couple of things I'm gonna talk about. I'm gonna have a criticism of Josh Shapiro about something he did a while ago that I would say is an example of ways politicians can fuel the positive feedback cycle of tribalism that can exacerbate anti-Semitism. It's unrelated to the recent thing he did, and God knows it doesn't justify having somebody set fire to your house. But I also want to talk about my own experience. I want to get back into Zaid, I think, Z-A-I-D, Jelani, and Glenn Greenwald, because Jelani had a brush with the Israel lobby trying to enforce a speech code when he was at, American Progress. Right. Yeah, I want to talk about that. And also my own experience. You know, I got I would say, you tell me whether this is like the Israel lobby trying to smear me or I'm reading too much into it. But that judgment will be rendered by Ron. And I'm willing to abide by whatever you say. I'll respect this adjudication. I hope you'll follow us into overtime. We'll talk about other stuff as well. And here we go.